It's Matt Segundo here, and if there's one thing that gets my Kaluki, it's the fact that they can't name this simple card game by its proper name. It is, as I understand it, Rummy. Now, for understandable reasons, I have an affinity for card games that are not only named after alcoholic beverages, but that are actually played for alcoholic beverages. Never underestimate the advantages of a barter system, particularly when you have a depleted checking account, you can't pay the bills, and you just want to drink your overstated sorrows away.
All right. Welcome to the Bat Segundo Show. I'm here with Howard Jacobson, most recently the author of Kaluki Nights. Welcome to the show.
Lovely to be here.
My first question, especially since you indicated before we started rolling that you have been on a two-week tour, Kaluki Nights came out in the UK in July of 2006, and here it is November 2007, and you're still talking about this book. Is it strange to keep talking about a book that you had finished, say, a year before, came out already, and it's just been ongoing?
It is when you've not been doing it for a bit, but when you're on a run, as I'm on a run now, I've done nothing but talk about it every day for the last 3 weeks in America, and the paperback's just come out in England, so every day for the last 2 months in England, I'm now on a run. In fact, I've written another novel since then, and I can't remember what this other novel is. I can only think about Kaluki Nights now. You get going, and it fills your mind. But it's always strange at first when there is that year's gap between the finishing of a novel and its coming out. You think, what is it? And you're on another one. What is this book? And what you don't always know when you're talking about a novel now is whether you're remembering the novel or you're remembering the last thing you said about it in Houston or Atlanta.
That's actually a good point. Or are you remembering what people are telling you about the novel as opposed to what you yourself had put into it?
I wish people would tell me about the novel things that I really wanted to remember. Actually, that's not fair. People are saying some very nice things about the novel. It's your own. I am an egoistical writer, and I remember my own thoughts, and I think that's a really good thing to have said. And there's a part of my mind that wants to remember that really good thing I said about Kaluki Nights. But it is true. It is one of those slightly, it's not mystical, but one of those mysterious things that the more you talk about a novel that you've read, no matter how many hours have gone into the writing of it, you suddenly do find things in the novel that you didn't know were there by virtue of this strange exercise of talking about it. And I'm enjoying discovering, 3 years on, what exactly it was I was doing 3 years ago.
What was sort of the most surprising discovery, at least most recently?
I'm just trying to remember. Just a minute. What was it? I had a really good thought on the plane coming in from wherever I was yesterday, Detroit, about this. And I've now forgotten what it was. Yes, I do know what it was. It's to do with, you always worry as a Jewish English writer in America, that one of the things that they say to you here is, we've done all that. You're struggling with something that we've dealt with. And someone said something to me in, not Detroit, Atlanta. I was reading a little bit at the beginning of the novel when much play is made of the fact that the hero, who is a cartoonist, can't draw some of the more sexual details in some homoerotic cartoons that he is employed to copy for a pirate of gay eroticism. And he says he can't do it because he can't imagine what it's like wearing tight leather pants or tight denims, because Jewish men wear loose pleated trousers and a cardigan. The joke being that Jewish men don't live in their body. Someone who was taking me around Atlanta who heard that said, you're wrong there, you know. We've passed all. You might be like that in England. We've passed all that. We've dealt with the body. We're now at home in the body. And I thought, isn't that right? Then am I dealing with a problem that's gone? But then I remember that every Jew I've actually met over here is in exactly the same state as I am. They might be out playing a round of golf, but they are living in their heads. They do live in their heads more than in their body. Their neuroses are exactly the same as the English neuroses. And I thought, I'm actually, the thing that I thought they'd told me that I was dealing with that's out of date is not in fact out of date. I'm not sure that this is an answer to the actual question you asked me, but it's an answer to another question that you might yet go on to ask me.
Well, as it happens, it does sort of lead into my next question. So you have me. But one thing that really, I think the primary thing that struck me about reading Kaluki Nights is sort of the similarities and the differences between British Jews and American Jews, and I'm actually a Jew from Canada, so there are even yet additional sort of nuances. And I guess just to talk both generally and specifically to the book about why it is that you can come over to America and get a sense that there's so many similarities in terms of how Jews think. And yet there are these subtle differences that I can identify and say, well, this isn't part of, say, my experience, this isn't part of American experience. So I guess just to sort of, you know, talk about that more generally.
Well, it is interesting. One of the things that I've never done a tour of America before. If you hear grievance in my voice, there is grievance in my voice. I don't know why I've not done a tour of America before. I don't know why other of my Jewish books haven't touched Americans quite the way this one has. But this one has, so I ain't going to complain. But one of the things I always wondered about was how would I go down? How would I personally go down? Sometimes I've seen American reviews of my books which talk about them as though they come from another planet. And yet whenever I've met Americans, American Jews or American Gentiles in America, I've always felt I've got on with them exactly as I get on with the English, even more so, actually. I've always felt I actually have an accord with them, with Americans, Jews or Gentiles, that's stronger than my accord with the English.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because I think I'm more like them, because I think if you're Jewish in England, you're not English, however much you try to be English. And I've played at being an Englishman for, you know, a half a century or more. I've taught English literature. I've stood up in defense of the English language. My heroes, when I was teaching English literature as an academic in Cambridge and other places, I wasn't teaching Philip Roth. I was teaching Jane Austen. When people say, you know, Philip Roth must be a great hero of yours, I say, well, you know, he's a great writer. But Jane Austen is the hero of mine, George Eliot, Dickens. I've been steeped in the English tradition. But personally, I'm not there. And I think when the English hear me talking about those people, I think they're amazed in the same way that they'd be amazed to hear a bear talk or something or other. Isn't it amazing that he can do it? So I've always felt alien or foreign. And I come here, and if I may put it like this, it's not that you're all alien and foreign here, but you are a place still discovering who you are. And if you're an alien, then that's wonderful, because you feel you can make a contribution to who you are. Whereas in England, it's laid down, it's been done thousands of years ago. You can only ever be a guest, a visitor, however well they treat you, and they treat us fine in the main, you are still a guest. So I come here and I feel, I'm in a world in which everything's being discovered. Isn't this great? And going around the traps, talking in Atlanta and Detroit and St. Paul and San Francisco, the audiences, I've had no trouble reaching the audiences. The things that make people laugh, the things that make people gasp in England have made them laugh and gasp here. In fact, interestingly, I thought jokes would be the problem. I thought, I like making jokes, I like being funny. For me as a writer, I want to make people laugh to the point of tears, seriously laugh. And as a speaker, when I'm talking about my books, the same. And I thought maybe laughter would be the problem. Laughter hasn't been the problem at all. They have laughed willingly, they've got every joke. Some of the things in my book that where there have been problems have been the more serious ones. Things where people gasp with emotion in England, there hasn't quite been that here. And I think that's to do with the shock quality of it. They can cope here with, because they're used to it, with comedians going in any old direction and taking all sorts of risks, and they can cope with that here. But when seriousness takes a risk, there's a scene I like to read when the hero of the book, as a tiny boy, says Jew for the first time, Jew, and the father thinks it's the sound of a train. Father, who is an atheist and a communist and doesn't want his son saying Jewish, but doesn't want his son growing up to be a Jewish boy or anything, says that's the train sound, isn't it? Woo-woo or choo-choo. And the little boy says, no, Jew. People are very touched by that in England, particularly with its denouement. Over here, I think there was some feeling, is he being rude about Jews? There's just that slight watchfulness about what risks you can take, not with comedy, but with seriousness. But otherwise, no, I feel I've, and particularly now after 2 or 3 weeks on the road, I actually feel I'm at home.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about comedy, just because I agree with you. Most, if not all, the jokes that were in at least Kaluki Nights, I thought, yeah, there's some correlation to jokes I've heard growing up or jokes that are circulated in, say, the New York Jewish community. And yet, yeah, I guess just to hear a bit more about why there is this sort of convergence of comedy. Is it just because Jews have a particular way of making fun of themselves or relating to the world? Like that, yeah.
I've written a book on comedy because I'm mad on thinking about comedy. I wrote a book called Seriously Funny. I made a big television series about it in England too. I love talking about comedy. I love doing it, and I love talking about it. Sometimes people don't think you should talk about comedy because they think it spoils the joke or something. I think that's philistine. I think comedy is as much a subject to be philosophical about as any other. But on the business of Jewish comedy, look, I think it's like this. I think of the Jewish joke as the most extraordinary strategy for survival. that's ever been discovered.
As if we make fun of ourselves first, they can't get us.
They can't. So it's exactly the same strategy as a psychologist will tell you, you know, animates a masochist. Masochists are terrified about what might be done to them. They get in first. They visit upon themselves that which they dread will be visited. But in a Jewish joke, it goes further than that. It's very clever because it not only says, look, however cruel you can be to us, we can anticipate that. Literally, anticipate that and be there first and be crueler. We can do it better. We can be smarter about it. What can you do with us? You break our bones, you Cossacks charge us down, you know, in your horses, your Nazis put us in a camp. We do it with our brains, we do it with our wits. We are so much more refined and subtle in our cruelty than you are. And by that means, intellectually at least, spiritually at least, we win. We might not win the physical battle, but we win every other battle. Now, out of that victory, of course, there's much to lose. Out of that victory, I think, as Freud said, you know, that our cleverness is our virtue, but it's our grace. But it's also a problem for us, too, because, you know, we are too smart for our own good sometimes. But nonetheless, we've got to be, when you've been kicked around the way we've been kicked around, you have to have your victories. And our victory is in our intelligence, and our supreme victory, I think, is in our sense of humour, in the Jewish joke. And what Gentiles who get Jewish jokes, and any bright Gentile gets a Jewish joke and covets a Jewish joke and wishes he could make a Jewish joke, tries to make a Jewish joke and can't make a Jewish joke, because you've got to have, it's like the shibboleth, the real test of the Jew is can he make a Jewish joke or not.
It's sort of like that Seinfeld episode with the dentist who converted so he could tell Jewish jokes That was the gist of it, and of course it went on and on, and it became this really strange examination of how, you know, a non-Jew could appropriate. And that actually sort of ties into another line of questioning I want to get into you with, which is, you know, degree of appropriation. We see this with how Max relates to his wives, and especially Zoe and her sort of interesting, to say the least, relationship with Jews, be it the foster family and, of course, with Max. So
yes.
I guess I wanted to hear a little bit more about you with regards to appropriation and how it relates to the book.
Tell me more about what you actually mean by appropriation, the appropriation of...
Well, first of all, what I was saying before about a non-Jew taking on Jewish jokes, but also in terms of, you know, Jewish-Gentile relationships.
Yes, okay, I've got it. Yes. I was thinking about this the other day, and actually this helps me to answer the question I was trying to think of before. What things have I discovered about the book? I can now give you the same answer to both questions. What things have I discovered about the book that I didn't realize I'd written, and what is this about appropriation? I hadn't realized that what I'd written was... Because this is a book about anti-Semites, it's about everything Jewish. It's got anti-Semites in it, every kind of anti-Semite. It's got Jewish anti-Semites. It's got Jews who abandoned Jews. It's got Holocaust deniers. It's got them, and it's very punitive about, it's even got Nazi figures from the past, imagine. Very punitive and unforgiving and a bitter, comically bitter book about those things. But it's also got Gentiles who love Jews. And it occurred to me that some of the most sympathetic figures in the novel, and I hadn't realised I'd done that, are Gentiles who love Jews. And I'm not saying that the saving of the Jews is going to be the Jew-loving Gentile. Of course I'm not saying that. But that there is a lot of warmth expended in the book that I hadn't realised I was doing. The last word of the novel goes to a non-Jewish woman who's at the... German woman, in fact, a half-German woman who's at the centre of the love interest in the book. And she pronounces quite tragically upon the lives of the Jews with whom she's been emotionally and romantically inclined. There's a very nice man who marries the hero's sister, who takes him to a deli, not unlike the one we're sitting in, if we can mention where we're sitting, in order that he can find out the names of all, you know, what's a nish? No, it's not a nish, it's a knish. You've got to use the K, you've got the hero tells him. He just wants to love Jew. We forget at a time when there is anti-Semitism around, and where I come from in England at the moment, there is a lot of anti-Semitism around. Not the brute sort on the street, but the intellectual sort on the campuses, on the universities. Every university is a hotbed of it at the moment in England. And you forget at such a time that there are people in the world who do adore Jews and love Jews and wish they were Jews, and there's a lot of benign feeling towards Jews. I think there probably always has been. Not much help for you if there's a pogrom going on. But it's very important to us that we remember that there is that kindness. And in any book about, I am glad that I remembered, even if I didn't realise that I was that I was doing that. One of his wives, one of his many anti-Semitic wives, my hero marries women who are anti-Semitic. The question whether they're anti-Semitic before he marries them or after is a question for the reader. But one of them is a girl who really wanted to be Jewish and who lived next door to a Jewish family and was beguiled by them, in the way that you often hear Gentiles saying that they were beguiled by the way a Jewish family, if they've lived in a quiet Gentile part of the world, a Jewish family scintillates. You know, they embrace things with a zest that she's not accustomed to. She feels that the family she lives in is mute and silent. All they do is go walking in the country. This Jewish family comes by and flash at her with their wit, and she falls in love with them. But they reject her. They reject her because they feel that their sons, their boys, will fall in love with her, and that's the thing that they're not going to have. Hers is a kind of tragedy, actually. She is somebody who would love Jews and be loved by Jews if she could. And her fight with the hero, I take to be upsetting.
And yet, in a weird way, Max's third wife, who is Jewish, he seems to regard much more malevolently than his first two wives, even though she is Jewish. But it seems as if somehow she gets the short end of the stick, at least from his recollections.
Yes, I mean, that's very specific and uncharacteristic in a way, and bears no relation to my biography. I've married three times. It's a coincidence. This is not the story of my life. Max marries three times. I've married three times. I've been married to a non-Jew, a half-Jew, and a full Jew, and I'm married to complete Jew now, and it's my happiest marriage, in fact. It's Max's most unhappy marriage. It's my happiest marriage. I hope it's my last marriage. But, I mean, what I wanted to do with her, actually, was to render a particular kind of Jewishness that's in the air at the moment, the anti-Zionist Jew. I don't think a Jew has an obligation to be a Zionist, but I think there's a particular pitch of anti-Zionism that a certain kind of Jew goes in for, particularly this kind of Jewish woman who wears sandals. I see the sandals as that's the giveaway. A woman who wears sandals all the time, that's an ideological statement about being in love with simplicity and third worldism and things. And that kind of Jew, and I know several of them in London, seem to me, you know, a particular contemporary poison. And that's what she's doing there.
It seems like you have been criticized for stances you've taken on Israel in your columns and being accused of being either overly Zionist or even just Zionist. So, and it always strikes me that Zionist is such a loaded term when it shouldn't be. But yet this is what has built up over the last 100-odd years, that, you know, if you can't say anti-Semite or anti-Jewish, it's like, well, we'll call them, you know, Zionist, and therefore...
There's a book to be written, and it probably is being written even as we talk. I'm sure it's been written by several people about how Zionism has come to be, how the meanings of Zionism, just even the look of the word, the letters, the bodying forth of all that's in Zionism has come to change from something which once upon a time for George Eliot at the end of the 19th century could be a spiritual longing, and even for the intellectual left until the 60s it was, you know, all their sympathies went into the Zionists. They were pioneers, they were Bundists, they were often atheists, they were communists, they were heroes. How that's changed, it's fascinating how it's changed, and it makes you realize that Jews were lovable as long as they were a small, frightened people on the, you know, on the edge of destruction. The minute Israel decided it didn't want to live on the edge of destruction, attitudes towards the Jews changed. But what does it mean? What does it mean, Zionism? Well, I mean, we know if you study a history of Zionism, that many different it contains many different aspirations. Some of which have been, I think, the most disappointing aspect of Zionism is that it has lost its secularity. It was an attempt to free, for many, it was an attempt to free Jews, not, and after all, it predates Nazism, not from oppression, though partly that, but just from the overzealous Hebraizing, orthodoxy, observance, obsession with observing that Jews had been reduced to as a consequence of not having a place of their own. So they only knew themselves in these little shtetls as scholars. Zionism was meant to free us from that. So I don't like to see Zionism being turned into something that's got so many religious overturns now. But leave that aside, that's not what the political objection to Zionism is now. And what does it mean? It means the aspiration of the Jewish people to have a country. I heard some well-known left-wing figure in England, just as I was leaving England a few weeks ago, explaining to us that Ahmadinejad in Iran had not said he wants to wipe Israel off the map. He just says he wants to remove Zionism, in the same way that anyone who wanted to get rid of Nazism didn't mean he wanted to destroy the German people, or communism did not mean he wanted to destroy the Russian people. It was simply something that they happened to take on, as though Zionism is a choice. Zionism is not a choice for Jews. Zionism is the aspiration to be there. If you oppose Zionism, you oppose the existence of Jews in Israel, and therefore you oppose the existence of the Jewish people. He who would wipe out Zionism would wipe out the Jews of Israel. End.
And yet certainly there are a number of ultra-Orthodox or extremely religious communities who would espouse that very
They're crackers. I think the sight of some of those people in Iran for a Holocaust denial conference was one of the most shaming things. I mean, I don't know what it is about us, but we are, you know, there are moments when I think about being Jewish and I think it is the most wonderful, mainly that's what I think, the most wonderful thing to be. I would not be anything else. I can't conceive of being anything else. But there are times when I see what some of us do and I think we are capable of visiting upon ourselves some of the cruelest. Who else would have a collection of people like those who would? All right. They believe we can't go to Israel until there's a Messiah. Fine. Okay. You're a crackpot, and you believe that. Fine. But to then join somebody who is saying, because he also happens to believe that, to join somebody in denying the Holocaust. They actually don't deny the Holocaust, but they will pretend that they deny the Holocaust for this other end. It is just contemptible. But we do have many versions of, though you're not allowed to say it, many versions of self-dislike. In Judaism, self-hatred is supposed to be one of those, you know, it's taboo. Jew self-hatred, I'm not a Jew, self-hating Jew. But you can't, I mean, it's part of us now. We've been knocked about. If a child is abused, it will come to evolve a lack of self-worth. There is somewhere ingrained in us genetically, and it erupts, if we're not careful, in all sorts of places and at all sorts of times. A lack of self-worth, as though what's been done to us, we've invited. And I think that's happening again in Israel. They're preparing for it. Come the anti-Semitism that might flow yet from anti-Zionism, these are the Jews who will say, well, see, this is what, we brought this upon ourselves again. And we have to watch those as we have to watch our most mortal enemies. They are our most mortal enemies. We are our most mortal enemies sometimes.
Well, it's sort of the difference, too, between Jews' community and Jews' individual pockets who all seem to want to fight with each other. It's like that old joke about a desert island. There's a synagogue you go to and the synagogue you don't go to. And in some versions, there's a synagogue that nobody goes to but has to be there.
Yes.
Why is it that there seems to be this propensity for there can never be one way. There has to be sort of these little pockets and everyone has to fight with each other.
Well, disputatiousness is in our genes, isn't it? I mean, it's our virtue too. We love to argue. I mean, it's at the heart of what we do as scholars. It's the heart of Talmudic scholarship. I love it at that level. I love it. I think it's fantastic that scholars will sit around. And I did some filming once in Israel at a yeshiva, and we were allowed to film an argument that was ongoing. It had been going on for 6 months. What brocha do you say? What blessing do you pronounce over toast? Is toast still bread? Is it the same blessing that you pronounce over bread, or has toast, by virtue of being heated up, changing its colour and changing its substance, become another article altogether? So now, I think that was wonderful that Jews will sit around and argue over bread and toast. I just wish they'd keep it to bread and toast and not the state of Israel.
No, that's a very good point. A book that just came out in the last few weeks that's been getting a lot of attention was Foreskin's Lament, a memoir by Shalom Auslander, who grew up in Muncie, which is about an hour and a half north of New York, in a very, very religious community. And one thing that he keeps being asked in interviews is about whether he's considers himself observant or religious or spiritual, and was sort of demarcating the differences as such. And I know that your own, say, observance or definition of Judaism as it pertains to you is very, very much your own. And I just wanted to hear what your take is on observance versus religiosity.
It's funny you should mention him, because I actually he and I did a talk together in Houston. We met each other, and I liked Foreskin's Lament very much. And we were both struck by the fact, and he was nice enough to say he liked Kaluki Nights very much. So it was quite a mutual admiration society. But we worked together on this while we were talking. And we were both struck by the fact that how we've come from such different points of view. He comes from you know, a particular version of Jewish orthodoxy, which he knows backwards and has come all, and that has kind of knocked him flying all the way out the other end of Judaism in a way. I've come from befuddled Judaism. When people say, what are you, liberal, conservative, well, I say I'm befuddled, because that's the Judaism that I came from in Manchester. We didn't know anything. We didn't know what being a Jew was. Being a Jew was not marrying a non-Jew. My father would say that to me. Don't marry out. And I'd say, why don't I marry out? Because if you marry out, you'll lose your Jewishness. What's my Jewishness? Marrying in. And what am I marrying into? All I was marrying into was the state of never marrying out. That was what Judaism
Which meant. As explanations go, it's pretty ludicrous.
Yeah, but it worked, because we all never wanted to upset anybody. And he knew somewhere or other. I mean, even the preposterousness of saying that was its own version of, you know, was Jewish subtlety. But Aslander says something which I absolutely agree with. He says they say to him that, you know, you're a disgrace to the Jews. You don't know anything about religious. And he's saying the truth is I am completely religious. You couldn't be more religious. I am obsessively religious. I'm frightened of God and the rest of it. And I feel the same. I feel I am, though I'm never like going to a synagogue. I'm uncomfortable. I don't practice. I don't care about milk, and I wouldn't know what it is I'm meant to do. I feel exactly the same way. He talks to God more than I do, but I still feel that I'm still in a dialogue with something. He's in an enraged dialogue. I'm not. I think if there were a God, he'd like a joke, and he'd like a battle. Aslander thinks God's only going to kill him. I think God might kill me, but maybe not just yet. But I'm also in, even when I talk about a Jewish joke or something or other, I feel that I'm speaking out of the heart of the Jewish people and being Jewish all the time. And so he's come one way, I've come another, and we've kind of met in the middle somewhere or other, where we both feel we are intensely Jewish without being what orthodox, practicing, observant people would call Jewish. And I think there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of interest in his book. There is, I'm pleased to say, a lot of interest in my book. And I think it's partly because people want this now. They don't want to drop their Jewishness. They don't want to change their name. They don't want to do that anymore. They don't want to hide and become seemingly, you know, waspy Anglo aristocrats. And, you know, they don't want that. They want to be Jewish, but they don't want to be Jewish in an old way. So I think it's a good thing that new ways of being Jewish are being talked about now, even if it's taking writers and novelists to do it. But then it always takes writers and novelists to lead the way. We're both kind of prophets. When I talked about myself at Houston as a kind of Abraham leading my people out, they laughed at that. They laughed at that. But Aslander knew what I meant. He feels the same in some way.
Well, that also ties into, there's a line in Kaluki Nights, and I'm going to have to paraphrase, because even though I've written it down, I can't seem to access it at this point, but it's the idea of, in all my years I never once met a Jew, however skeptical, who didn't, as it were, for special occasions, believe a bit. And yet, at least one thing I tend to observe is that there are more atheist Jews than atheist any other religion. So, you know, just... I guess let's get into this question of belief and believing a little bit versus believing wholeheartedly or believing not at all. It's this sort of, I guess, this looming specter of God or belief in some degree or another.
I think the believing a bit is terrific. I think believing a bit. I was with another Jewish writer in Atlanta. I've been with young Jewish writers everywhere. Me and young Jewish writers. I like them all. You've got some very bright Jewish writers. Very bright Jewish writer. A.J. Jacobs, The Year of Living Biblically. Yes. And he said, I think it's important that you pick and choose. And my hair stood on end because a few years ago I made a film out of a novel which people do read in America, not a novel, a travel book called Ruth Schmutz, which people do read here. And I made a travel film about it, which wouldn't be shown in America apparently because it frightened it would annoy Jews. God knows why. No Jew in England was annoyed. But in the course of that, as we were driving through Israel as part of this film, we saw the mount where Jesus delivered the Beatitudes. I thought, I'll be Jesus and deliver the Beatitudes. So I delivered my own, and I Beatitudes as Jesus, which I'm entitled to do as a Jewish boy driving by. So I went onto the hill that's called the mount, but it's just a little hill, in fact. So we found a mountain to make it more dramatic. And one of the things I said, blessed are the pickers and the choosers. Blessed are the pickers and the choosers. And the wonderful thing about our religion, although your rabbi won't like you for saying that, and the Orthodox won't like you for saying that, is that there's so much that we can think, we'll have a little bit of this, we'll have a little... I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's fantastic. Better that we pick and choose than that we feel, well, this is so preposterous, we'll reject it altogether. What's wonderful about Judaism, why it's kept going, I think, is that in the face of so much that's ancient and mouldy and mouldering and verschimmelt, as my father used to say, there are things which, in the face of so much which is preposterous and outlandish and outrageous and impossible, there is still so much that we feel we want to adhere to. And that's great about us, that we have been... It's to do with social adhesiveness or something. All these things about Jews that we're told isn't really what Jewishness is about, that we like a party, that we like a bar mitzvah, that we like mixing with our relatives, that we like doing the hokey-cokey with our aunt. I mean, that's... All those things are, in truth, Jewishness. That's what Jewishness is about. People are staring at me. I'm getting self-conscious here in the thing. So, I think the social aspects of Judaism, our love of one another, our love of what we look like, our physical love of each other's company, the tactile thing that we have. You meet a Jew and you want to put your arms around them. That just something that we vibrate physically to one another when we meet. I've gone on these Jewish journeys and I've met Jews everywhere, and immediately I look at myself and, what are you doing? I'm falling in love. What a lovely Jewish man. What a lovely Jew. In Detroit, where I've just come from, I've met 100. I've got new aunties. New aunties who, you know, they drove me from here to here. Then they come and heard me, met me for 5 minutes. Then they came to my gig, sat on the front row and looked up at me, quelling. The way my aunties were quelling, you know, or they'd met me for 5 minutes and already I was one of the family and they were pleased for me for doing well. That's Jewishness. That too is Jewishness.
It's funny you bring up picking and choosing, because by virtue of there being 613 mitzvot, automatically every and all Jew has to pick and choose, because there are certain mitzvot you just can't do because the conditions aren't right, we're not all in Israel, the Messiah hasn't come, etc., etc. So with that in mind, I'd have to say, yeah, why don't we pick and choose more and just revel in this?
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you. I'm annoyed that he got in there, that A.J. Jacobs, with the year of living biblically. I could have done the year of the lifetime of living unbiblically and breaking all 600 and how many of them that there are. But, I mean, I would even extend this to, and I had this conversation with somebody, can't remember where now, Houston, Detroit, don't know, about the marrying in and the marrying out. And one woman wanted to say, I think Jews worry too much about marrying out, because sometimes the people you marry out to, it's like bringing people in. And other people at the table said, no, you can't say that. But I think that, I've seen that. How many people have we found and this is another answer to your appropriation question, how many people do we see who marry into the Jewish and then become more Jewish than their Jewish spouse? I've seen it so many times. And we shouldn't feel worried about that. We shouldn't feel that they don't belong. We should be delighted that there are people out there who are glad to be
And that's
be
not
in.
Even getting into conversion and degrees of conversion
nothing. They like it. I don't know anyone that's married. I'm sure there will be people. I don't know anyone I've not met anyone that's married into Judaism from somewhere else that hasn't somewhere or other really liked that or found some things in it that are really attractive, that hasn't gone into it for that. And I don't think we should be... I think we worry too much about marrying out.
I'm going to switch directions just a bit, because you had mentioned earlier in the interview about sandals. And there was
about
this... Sandals.
Sandals.
And I just... Because there was this long passage in Kaluki Nights where it was almost like an extended rant about sandals that, you know, that shouldn't wear them at any point except the... So what's the deal? What's wrong with sandals?
It's about simplicity. Sandals, I mean, I actually do, I own a pair of sandals and I wear them on the beach. But there's certain people who wear sandals in the day. They wear sandals for work. They wear sandals to go to university in. Whenever you see photographs of the people who are leading the pro-Palestinian groups at English universities, either to boycott Israeli universities or something, they're always in sandals. They're always in sandals. Mainly we don't look at their feet because we're too busy looking at their Brenti faces, or we don't always see their feet. But they wear sandals. Sandals are an ideological statement. They say that we believe in simple, oppressed people. They are sort of saying that we do not like the modern capitalistic world of shine and money. Jews do like the capitalistic world. Jews love the material things of the world. I like Jews for that. Jews like to shine and sparkle and buy if they can afford to buy and look good. Jews know that, you know, that if there is a God, he resides in the material as well as in the spiritual thing. If there is a God, God will say, go to, look at the state of you. Go clean yourself up. Here's some money. Go to Armani. Come out looking decent. You should look good. You should be proud of how you look. You should look. And the sandals don't only embrace the simple-mindedly oppressed. I mean the oppressed as in the mind of the simple-minded people. But they're also a statement against the material good things of the world, which Jews adore. And we can parody ourselves for adoring them, but no one else should.
It's funny to bring up sandals in light of A.J. Jacobs, because the cover of his book shows him in sandals, too.
Yes, of course. Well, there's that version. But that too is believing that you can live... that you can live a simple life. You can't live a simple life. A rich life, a rich life is a sophisticated life. An intellectually rich life will never reduce itself to, you know, to a few simple life. It's why we know when, you know, the Hare Krishna people passes in the street. Why we know that, you know, that they possess nothing for us, you know, that they cannot have any truth. Truth is not found by throwing things away. Whether I'd go in so far as to say that truth is found by accumulating as many goods of the world as you can, going shopping every day, maybe not. But it is that willful simplification. And with the simplification of your clothes goes the simplification of your politics. There are downtrodden and there are downtreading. Well, there aren't.
Now, Kaluki Nights, also a major theme and a major exploration is the Holocaust. And it was interesting to me to read about this as those like Max and Manny who had sort of were in the specter of the Holocaust, especially in light of a book, Irène Némirovsky's Suite Française, which was written just as all of this was happening. So you have this essentially snapshot and contemporary version versus the ramifications. And I guess it's more just an interesting contrast. And what prompted you to really delve into the ramifications?
I never know what prompts me. I'm never good at answering questions about what prompts me, because I never know what prompts me. But I know what I did. I remember vividly reading The Scourge of the Swastika when it came out in the 1950s in Manchester. The Scourge of the Swastika by Lord Russell of Liverpool was the first published full book that told us of what had happened, and that gave us photographs, upsetting photographs if you were 12 or 13, because there were photographs that touched us at a time when you don't want anything to touch a sexual nerve, that did, because they showed photographs of women who tortured men, tortured German women who tortured Jewish men. There were detailed sexual accounts of what the torture consisted of, which gets into your head if you're a little Jewish boy. There were naked women prisoners. It was all very, very upsetting. And when I was thinking about the story, I was thinking, we must all have been very upset by that book. I mean, I know I was upset by that book. And I thought it would be very interesting to think of the ways in which people were differently, Jewish boys were differently upset by that work. And really, Kaluki Nights is the story of that. That's essentially at the heart of it, its story. A number of boys read that book and their lives are altered and in some cases... disastrously ruined, truly ruined. Catastrophes follow, as it were, from that book. No one's saying it's only that book. That book then comes to stand for, if you like, the whole business of knowing about being Jewish, bearing the burden of Jewish memory, which I take very seriously. Almost as though, without at all wishing to demean, you know, the seriousness of what has happened to true victims, almost as though one wants to say, well, there is another kind of victim, and that Jews go on being victims. And I think we do go on being victims. I don't think we've any choice. I think we should face it. This book, if you like, is one man's attempt to find a vocabulary for describing and understanding and thinking about going on being this new generation of victims.
And also in a way that isn't tackling it head on, because, you know, growing up Jewish and exposed to the Holocaust, one criticism that I had to some degree, but certainly among my peers, we're getting the shove down our throats and it starts to lose meaning. So, you know, should there be more meaning attached as we get further and further away from the actual event? Or is it just a matter of, you know, coming at it from a side view, a lateral view and the like?
Well, I think the latter. I think coming at it from a side view is very important. But it might be the case that we are sick of having the Holocaust shoved down our throats. And I know that we can't go on, wonderful as Primo Levi is, we can't go on writing about the Holocaust as though we are Primo Levi. We can't, and it's an affront actually to try. One or two people were critical of me. This book is a comedy as well as being a tragedy, but it never makes light. My comedy makes heavy, not light, and it certainly never makes light of the Holocaust or the victims. But we do need another vocabulary. The next new generations need another vocabulary. We weren't there. We can't write like Primo Levi. A lot of books try and pretend that we were there. Partly our interest in that, in the Suite Française, to have another book written at the time.
Yeah.
Because only books that were written at the time by people who were there can give us that experience. For those of us who come after, it's another experience. But it's not an experience of putting it behind us. There's no closure, as we say, on that. It's not something we can get over. You know, sometimes Jews say, get over it. My hero's father, more or less, says, get over it, live again. I don't think we can get over it. And since we can't, and I don't think we will ever get over it. I mean, let's think of Judaism as we understand it is a religion that was forged already in exile. It's built upon a concept of a consciousness of suffering. It's built upon ourselves as a victim people. To think, you know, what some people say, and I've said it, you know, the trouble with the Holocaust is it gives us an identity as a victim people, and we're not only a victim people. Well, we're not only a victim people, but we were a victim people before there was a Holocaust. That's what we do at Pesach. We talk about our getting away, but what we remember is that we were there.
You know, in every generation you must feel as if you personally were cast out of Egypt.
Yes, yes. Yes,
so it really is, you know, resonance of history and taking it on for yourself,
yes,
and feeling it.
Yes, absolutely. And we sing songs about it, and we laugh, and a lot of the best Pesach things, we sing the Dayenu, and we, you know, and there are lots of terrific songs, and we the kids play games, and we hide things, and it's a family affair. And in a way, we've made something happy out of it. But at the time, if you were the people in there, it would not have been such a happy experience. And I can imagine people, you know, coming out of Egypt and saying, well, you shouldn't be having parties about that. It's a much more solemn thing. We have to go on finding a way of both remembering and not forgetting, but of remembering, but going on with our lives at the same time. And that's where comedy comes in, because I think comedy is one of the ways that we do it well. Good comedy in which we both remember and do honour to the pain, but also look forward. A good joke looks forward as well as bang.
One other thing that struck me too is that the Jewish communities or Jewish people you're describing were outside of London. And what limited experience I have with English Jews are in London, within pockets of London, and I guess, you know, this sort of goes back to the similarities and differences, but what of, you know, the pockets within English Jewish communities and outside, and, you know, what does one do differently from the other in those experiences?
I've always liked being a Manchester Jew. Manchester is north of England, about 200 miles north of London. Those 200 miles count a lot more in England than they count here. Here it's a hop and a skip in a motor car. That's a, you know, you make a will before you go to Manchester from London. And I've always liked, and it's the second Jewish community. We're different from the Londoners. Manchester Jews are different from London Jews because of, it's not our Jewishness that's different. It's that we take on, Jews have always been very good at taking on and using what they find. You know, they've had to. So Jews have been good Germans and good Russians, and, you know, it's a lesson we never, it's a mistake we never stop making, but there's nothing we can do about it. We fall in love with host cultures and things, and we appropriate them, and we use them, we build them into our Jewishness. Jews in Manchester are, Manchester people altogether are very sardonic. They are, it comes from feeling that they are not at the centre of things. They don't have the conceit, the sometimes humorless conceit that metropolitan people do. They are ironical. They live under low, dark, menacing, melancholy skies. They are self-denigrating and self-effacing. They're funny in a way that you hear London comedy and it's quick, it's fast, it's spivvy, it's sharp. It's all about how you've done somebody down. In Manchester, it's all about how you've been done down. It accords beautifully with being Jewish. I found being Jewish was much more like being a Mancunian than it is like being a Londoner. I don't quite think London Jews get it. They're too sharp, I think. Quite like something schlemely, if you like. No, self-consciously and knowingly and therefore cleverly schlemely about just Manchester people. So add that to Jewishness and you've got another string to your bow.
I guess the other reason I'm asking is because there was a book that came out last year, Naomi Alderman's Disobedience, that was trumpeted as the secret community of London Jewish community. I thought, well, is anyone going to do that with Manchester or Edinburgh or Glasgow? It just seemed it was an interesting book, but it almost seemed like the presentation was a bit of a fallacy somehow.
Well, what they were saying was this was the first book that's come out of the Orthodox community. I mean, to that degree, there's no reason why that couldn't have been written about Manchester. The Orthodox communities, I don't think there's a much... I think because they locked themselves away from the world so much, I don't think you'd notice much difference between a London Orthodox community and a Manchester Orthodox, because they're not anywhere. They don't inhabit any place. They're in judo space.
Yeah.
They're in sitsis space. So, I mean, to that degree, she was telling us something new, because mostly they don't write books. People who come out of that world don't write books, so we don't know about what it... And we also like to think that we have a kind of salacious curiosity about them that we half do and half don't want satisfying, really. But I'm not sure that there's any geographical specificity about that.
No, fair enough. One more question, which has to do with the title itself, since it is Kaluki, and how this word sort of resonates through the book, and you have Mick Kaluki come in and sort of the Jewish and the non-Jewish angle of it. And I'm also reading it going, yeah, but we play canasta. So I guess, you know, what? So first of all, why is there sort of this sort of resonance of card games?
Well, you don't only play canasta. I've met lots of Jews here on this trip who know what Kaluki is. Lots of Jews have played Kaluki. I think more people play...
Maybe it's a Canadian thing.
It could be, but I bet you play it. Some people would, or a generational thing.
That's true, too.
It's... Kaluki just always struck me as part... I like the sound of the word. It also always struck me as a particularly absurd game. We never played it at home, actually. My mother didn't play Kaluki. My hero's mother is not my mother. But it was always a game that struck me as interesting because no one ever seemed to know the rules. And I love the idea of the people falling out over the rules. And it was a game of yelling and screaming. The women would dress up for charity Kaluki nights. They'd play for pennies. They'd dress up, then would be glamorous. And as a little boy, I liked seeing these glamorous women turn up in other people's houses. They didn't come to ours to play Kaluki. And yell and scream in that wonderful Jewish way about, that's not how you play Kaluki. Slap their heads and walk out. And I've seen evenings, I truly have seen evenings, which have been regarded by all participants as a really wonderful, wonderful Kaluki night, without a game of Kaluki having been played. There's yelling and screaming about the rules and all the other thing. I also wanted to do, so there's that. I also wanted to go two ways on it, that my hero is very austere about his mother playing Kaluki when there are other things she should be doing. For him, Kaluki stands for Jewish Philistinism. For me too, partly. But I also know, because I have a down on English Jews' Philistinism. I hate it that English Jews go and see the worst musicals and read the worst books, and that when you go to a holy person's house, you'll see, you know, the bookshelves have got row upon row upon row of, you know, beautifully bound leather and gold Hebrew text. And if they have do they have any novels?
No.
Do they have do they have any poetry? Do they have? Then, but they'll probably have a Harry Potter. And I think that's unforgivable. If we're going to be the people of the book, we are the people of the book. And if you as a rabbi are the people of the book, be a person of the book. If you're going to talk to God and talk through God's holy word on Friday and Saturday, on Sunday you read Saul Bellow or you read me. You don't read Harry Potter. That's a holy obligation on you. So my hero uses Kaluki to sort of to catch that English Philistinism. But the novel also realises that that's somewhat absurd of him, because he also likes the sexiness of those nights. But it's funny, because that goes right to the heart of the book as I originally intended it, when it really was going to be an expression of my anger with the Philistinism of English. Very hard to get Jews in England to just, you know, to read properly. I mean, we are the people of the book. I was travelling in Jerusalem once, writing Ruth Schmutz, and a Jewish accountant, to tell me he was an accountant, Orthodox accountant, came up to me and said, "You're Howard Jacobs." "I know you, yeah." I was like being recognised. He said, "Tell me something, Howard, tell me something. Why do you write a book?" I thought this was a question about, you know, when you could have been a heart surgeon or a lawyer, why you went. An accountant's question. Didn't mean that. "Howard, we've got a book." that you've got that on the orthodox side when they won't read anything, or then you've got the other Jews who just want to go to see Chitty Chitty Bang Bang or the latest musical in London and read rubbish. I mean, so many of my relatives are like that, or my in-laws are like that, or the Jews who live out of town are like that.
Right.
And then you've got the Jews who are too intellectually grand to have anything to do. They wouldn't dream of reading, you know, a book by a Jew, and so they're escaping from Judaism. So it's as if so many things in Judaism conspire to stop them reading me, I suppose. To stop them reading me. I don't think that was the reason I wrote the novel, but there was some anger with my Jews that, you know, I don't think I should know a Jew in England that doesn't read me. I shouldn't. I'm Abraham. I'm reading them out. The least that they can do is read the book. They could say they don't want to be led out by me. And then that sort of, the book became an entirely different thing. Other things were happening in England, you know, there was Holocaust denial was on the uprise again, and suddenly I thought, well, I've got bigger fish to fry. But the Kaluki just stayed as a nice, and it had a nice mellifluous sound. And I didn't think we'd keep it was my working title, because I thought, well, not enough people know what it means. But it's a funny title, and my publisher wanted it to stay. I think it was in St. Paul, a woman put up her hand and said she felt really aggrieved because she'd played Kaluki as a woman, and she thought this was a book about, you know, famous Kaluki occasions. I offered her money back, but she was not.
You don't want to write about famous Kaluki occasions, then?
Well, here's my failing as a novelist. If I took the business of novel writing a little less seriously, then I probably would write about famous Kaluki occasions. But of course, I'm Jewish, so I take the making of art, as all Jews take the making of art, desperately seriously, because we know it's blasphemy. We're not supposed to make art. So every time we make art and we go in competition with God, we know we are doing a major, major thing. A major thing. It's a majorly transgressive thing. So we've got to get... I mean, this is why Jews are so bloody solemn, from Philip Roth to Mark Rothko to, you know, whoever. We take it so seriously.
And on that note, I will wrap it up. Thanks so much. This is great.
Thank you. Real pleasure.